Chapter 21. Delzoon. When they returned to the main recaptured complex in the upper halls, the group from the mines found Drizzt resting a bit more easily, though he remained far, far away, his eyes closed, his fingers not responding when Brunner or Catti Bree took his hand. Still, after a quick check on him, measuring his breathing and sensing the peace within the darkness, Catti Bree took hope that her husband would survive, though whether he would ever again be a great warrior, none could know. Catti Bree had learned from bitter personal experience in her previous life how debilitating some injuries could be, no matter how much magical healing the priests might apply. She had never been the same warrior after the defense of Mithril Hall, when that giant-hurled stone had caught her. She had survived, but could not bear children, and could not hope to fight as well with a sword as before. But she had survived, and she had thrived for years afterward, turning her thoughts to arcane magic. Perhaps it could be so with Drizzt, she pondered, and a smile found its way onto her pained face as she fantasized about having Drizzt as her student, reading the texts beside him at the Ivy Mansion in Longsaddle, laughing at him good-naturedly when his first spells fizzled, much as he had taunted her in the early days of her martial training. "It will be all right," she said to Brunner, squeezing his shoulder and bending low to peck him on the hairy cheek. "The sun will rise." Brunner's stubby fingers patted her hand and he nodded. He was too choked up to respond, though, and so Catti Bree kissed him again and left him alone with Drizzt in the room. "Ah, elf, it's harder than I thinked," Brunner said to his friend when she was gone. "I'm needin' ye, elf, but ye get your sleep, aye? And when ye come back, a dwarf'll be on the throne of Gontalgrim, don't ye doubt?" He glanced around, noting Drizzt's weapon belt hanging over the back of a chair, along with the rest of the drow's equipment. Brunner went over and slid the repaired twinkle back into its sheath. He paused before the scimitar went all the way in, inspecting his handiwork. He had to nod, for it had been a solid repair. But of course, the formerly magical weapon would never be as powerful. Brunner glanced back at Drizzt and wondered the same for his friend. The dwarf's hand slid down the weapon belt to a pouch, and from it he lifted a familiar onyx figurine. A twinkle came to Brunner's eye as he brought Guinevar up for closer inspection. Might he take her with him? Would she come to his call and serve him as she had so well served Drizzt? Or perhaps he could give the cat to Catti Bree? But it didn't seem right to him. He shook his head and moved to the bed, placing Guinevar down gently on Drizzt's chest, then lifting the drow's arms up to hug the panther. This was where she belonged. Only. "Ye come back to us, elf," Brunner whispered. "Ain't ready to say farewell to ye just yet." He gave a last pat to Drizzt and left the room, considering the dark road in front of him and wondering if he'd get his wish, because it seemed very possible to Brunner that he'd never speak to his dear elf friend again. In the next room over, he heard the quiet voice of Malabritches Fellhammer, whispering encouragement to her fallen sister. Tannabritches was in far worse shape than Drizzt, and Catti Bree, for all her efforts, could not give Brunner any assurances that the young dwarf lass would survive her brutal wounds. The Glabrezu's pincer had crushed and gashed her midsection. If Catti Bree hadn't been right there with powerful healing magic, Tannabritches would never have gotten out of those mines alive. Even now, her hold on life seemed tenuous indeed, her breathing shallow and raspy, her only sounds profound groans that came without conscious thought. Brunner pulled a chair in from the hallway outside the room, placing it right beside the chair holding Malabritches, the two of them close enough to Tannabritches as she lay on the small bed, to hear her labored breathing and the quiet, pained sounds. "Not wanting to lose her," Malabritches said quietly past the obvious lump in her throat. "All me life, been me and her, fist and fury. Not wanting one without the other."
"Aye, girl, but she can't be leaving," Brunner said,
and he snorted as he did, his emotions pouring forth. He couldn't stand seeing Tannabritches like this. His head and heart careened back to Citadel Felbar, to the early days of his second life when he had trained beside the wild Fellhammer duo, when he had served beside them, when he had fought beside them.
beside Tannabridge's in particular in one wild battle in the Rauven Mountains. Tannabridge's had been badly wounded in that fight, too, struck in the chest by an orc spear. All she had thought about as she fell was the safety of the others, of Brunner, whom she knew as her friend Little Arar. She had told him to get the others and run away, to leave her to her grim fate.
"Bah, but I didn't save ye then to watch ye die now, girl," Brunner growled in a harsh whisper. "Ye don't believe in me, ye hear?"
Malebridges took his hand and squeezed it tightly. He looked up at her, meeting her gaze, and tears streamed from his eyes. Malebridges shook her head, overwhelmed.
"I can't be letting her go," Brunner gasped,
and surely he was overwhelmed then, with Tannabridge's lying here and Drizzt in the room next door. He was as surprised by his reaction as was Malebridge's, for the depth of his pain cut straight to his heart. He really could not stand the thought of losing Tannabridge's now. When Emerus had given over the Fellhammer sisters to serve as part of Brunner's elite guard, the red-bearded dwarf's heart had leaped, more than he had truly understood. But now, seeing Tannabridge's lying there, so pale and near to death, he did understand, and surely his heart broke as he came to believe that she was slipping away from him forever.
"Ye got your gutbusters,"
Malebridge's said, but in a leading way that told Brunner she was fishing deeper. "King Brunner's to be surrounded by fighters, eh?"
"Not about that," Brunner snapped.
He sucked in his breath to steady himself, shook his head ferociously, and leaned forward, staring at the wounded lass, silently imploring her to live.
"Not about fightin'," he said. "About needin' her aside me when the fightin's done."
"When ye take the throne, you mean?"
The shock of Malebridge's words jolted Brunner upright, and he turned to regard her curiously.
"It'll be yourself," she said.
"Aye, but ye're the proper choice, I'm saying.
The great Emerus is so old, and even if ye gived him the throne, he'd not hold it for long. We'll be rid of the damned drow, don't ye doubt, and Brunner'll be king of Gontalgrim one day not far along."
Brunner didn't respond, but neither did he blink.
"You're thinking her your queen, ain't ye?"
the Fellhammer girl asked.
Again her words shocked Brunner, for he hadn't carried his thoughts and his pain that far along. His initial reaction was to shake his head in denial.
The whole proposition sounded ridiculous to him. He was a long way from claiming Gontalgrim's throne, after all. But as he considered Malebridge's question, which sounded more like an accusation, Brunner's biggest surprise was that he came to recognize that she wasn't wrong. He stammered something undecipherable under his breath, and his head swiveled back to consider the poor lass lying on the bed.
"Do ye love her, Arar?" Malebridge's asked.
"Aye,"
Brunner said, surprised by his honest answer.
"And your heart's breaking in seeing her in the bed like that, eh?"
"Aye,"
he weakly answered. Malebridge's grabbed him by the shoulder and yanked him around, forcing him to look her in the eye once more.
"And ye tell me true, me friend. What if it was meself in that bed, and me sister sitting here with ye? Where might Arar, where might Brunner Battlehammer be then, I'm asking?"
Brunner's face started to twist up in confusion, but his answer came from a place of clarity when he said,
"Same place."
His gray eyes opened wide as the weight of his words sank in. As he came to realize that he had just professed his love to Malebridge's and to her sister. Malebridge's yanked him closer then, and put her arm around his shoulders, lifting her hand to press Brunner's head onto her own strong shoulder for support.
"Don't ye be worried, me friend," she whispered in his ear. "Fist ain't leaving us. She just ain't."
"I done all I could,"
Bungalow Thump pleaded to the two dwarf kings and the others gathered in the throne room. Word of the disaster in the lower chambers had preceded him, but few details had come forth other than the deaths of 100 Battlehammer warriors and the 12th king of Mithril Hall. Bungalow Thump, himself wounded and battered, had come to the throne room to offer a full recounting to the leaders. Tolliver Harple stood behind him, head bowed respectfully, with Penelope and Kipper beside him. Bungalow Thump didn't leave out any details. He glanced back at Tolliver Harple and offered an apologetic shrug before he told of the failure of the Field of Feather Fall,
as he described poor dwarves bouncing onto the stone floor or onto the bodies of their fallen comrades. The dwarf's voice soared as he recounted the heroics of those trapped on the ground, and again he didn't exclude the Harples, taking great pains to accurately describe Keneally's brilliant improvisation.
"Aye, but she saved the lot of us," Bungalow Thump said, "and gived her own life in doing it." "Huzzah for Keneally Harple, then," Ragged Dane offered, drawing a stern look from Bruner, but one that didn't hold, and indeed Bruner joined in the cheer for Keneally.
"It seems as if it was more demon than drow opposing ye,"
Emerus Warcrown offered at that break.
"More demons and hordes of goblins and orcs," Bungalow Thump confirmed. "Saw a drow or two from the shadows and throwing spells, but none other."
"Goblins and orcs," Bruner muttered,
for surely he had seen his fill of the wretched orcs in recent months.
"Slaves of the damned drow."
As he said that aloud, he realized that much of it was likely true for the War of the Silver Marches as well. His thoughts careened to Lorgru, of the line of Obuld, and those orcs who once more rallied around that name in their professed desire to live in peace. Might the Treaty of Garum's Gorge have held if not for the damned drow?
Brunner shook the thought away.
"And them demons," Orethio Spikes offered. "Demons in the entry hall, demons in the mines! Darn Gontalgrim's more full of demons than dwarfs and drow together."
"I ain't seeing much difference between demons and drow meself," Emerus growled.
"Aye, to the abyss with them all,"
Ragged Dane added, and a great cheer went up all around the throne room, one rolling from bravado to a muted confusion, it seemed. The starkly mixed results of the three battles fought this same day had them all off balance. They had won in the entry hall, slaughtering demons by the score. Every defense had held strong, and every plan had been executed to near perfection, and the hero of that battle, Orethio Spikes, deserved every cheer and honor offered to him. And Conorad Braunanvil, too, would garner much of the credit for that battle in the entry cavern, for the defenses of that hall were his doing, offered with insight he had gained on the throne of the dwarf gods. But they had been defeated badly in the lower chamber, and it simply could not continue that each side could hold its own ground. For the drow had the great forge. That could not stand. As the cheering died away, Bruner rose and approached the throne, nodding, but with his expression grave.
"Ropes, I say," Emerus called. "Yourselves should have used the rappel to the cavern floor and not some wild magic."
"You cannot lay the blame with—" Penelope Harple started to protest, but Bungalow Thump held up his hand to silence her and did it for her.
"Nay, King Emerus, and sure to know that I am your loyal servant here, pledged in fealty and accepting of your judgments," he said. "But I cannot agree. Nay, for the plan was a good one, and oh, but we were hitting the floor in full charge."
"Until the magic fell away," Emerus reminded.
"Aye, but we could no know the power of the enemies below us," Bungalow Thump replied. "Ah, but they were thick with wizards and thick with demons, big demons by the score. By rope or by harple magic, we'd have lost many of our boys today, and we'd have ne'er gained the lower hall."
"Well said, Master Thump. And I'd not expect less of ye than that,"
Bruner replied before Emerus could, and with almost exactly the same words Emerus would have used. All eyes went to Bruner, and many bushy eyebrows, Emerus's included, lifted in surprise to see him sitting on the throne once more, hands solidly on the burnished arms of the great chair, eyes closed, and his whole body slowly swaying back and forth, and nodding, as if he was in a conversation with some unknown beings, given the throne upon which he sat, he likely was.
"But now we're known,"
Bruner said at length, his gray eyes popping open.
"Aye, and they be thick in the lower tunnels, eh? And with hordes of demons and a swarm of goblinkin."
He swept his gaze across the room, a sly smile creasing his fiery red beard. That stare settled on Emerus, who nodded his approval, then swerved to lock stares with Bungalow Thump.
"And we got an army of dwarves with blood kin to avenge," Bruner explained. "So tell me, me boys, which corner's getting ye betting pouch?"
That brought the biggest cheer of all, of course, and Penelope Harple put her hand on Bungalow Thump's shoulder, squeezing tight.
for Brunner had just absolved the Harples and the force Conrad had led below of any blame for the defeat, accepting Bungalow's explanation without question. And now Brunner had sworn vengeance, and woe to those below.
"Huzzah and hey-ho!" the cheering went on, all in the room joining in exuberantly. "Save two."
Brunner just sat there on the throne, listening to the whispers of Moradin carried in on the song of dwarven cheering, and Catti Bree stood off to the side, staring at her adoptive father, recognizing that Brunner had turned the corner on his grief and worry. The woman had worried that Drizzt would not return to her, but so too had she worried that Brunner would not in time at least. But now that latter fear washed away. There was her da, King Brunner Battlehammer, his eyes full of fight. There was no time for moping about, not with an army of drow and demons and goblinkin lying in wait below. No, now was the time for preparation and for vengeance. Catti Bree saw it clearly on Brunner's face. He meant to avenge Conrad and the Gutbusters. He meant to make them pay for the injury to Tenebrich's Fellhammer. And he meant to make them all pay dearly for the wounds they had inflicted upon his dearest friend.
"Woe to the drow,"
Catti Bree whispered under her breath, and she ended with a knowing smile and a nod. For King Brunner Battlehammer was coming for them.
"Seen him like this before?"
Emerus whispered to Ragged Dane as they made their way along the upper tunnels of Gauntlegrim, part of a grand procession, 4,000 of the dwarves geared for battle.
"Ain't good for his enemies,"
the old king said with a snort and a nod. Ragged Dane couldn't disagree. Brunner led the procession, Malabrich's Fellhammer at his side, Athrogate and Ambergris close behind. The solid stride of the red-bearded dwarf bespoke his determination. He was angry, outraged even, with his dear friends lying gravely wounded. But Brunner hadn't let that outrage take him to a place of recklessness by any means. His method for vengeance was clear-sighted and truly inspired. He had devised the plan of attacking the lower tunnels in careful consultation with King Emerus, Bungalow Thump, Orethio Spikes, Catti Bree, and the three Harples. He had devised the plan while sitting on the throne of the dwarf gods. King Brunner was purely focused and determined to get his revenge and to claim his prize, but every dwarf marching behind him went with full confidence that Brunner would lead the army onto the battlefield of his proper choosing, giving them the best chance of a great victory. The army divided into battle groups as they neared the last corridor, the same corridor that led to the landing where the first battle of the lower levels had gone disastrously wrong. Among all the ranks, clerics ran, casting spells of protection from fire and from cold, spells to mitigate wounds, and spells to bless the ranks. Brunner and his battle group, made up mostly of the Mithril Hall dwarves, including the remaining Gutbusters, veered into a side corridor along with the three remaining Harples and Catti Bree. All along the journey, the spellcasters remained busy creating small stones with enchantments of light. Now they went along the lines of Battlehammer dwarves, handing those light pellets out to every commander, and with all the leftovers going to predetermined foot soldiers. If all went as planned, this battle group would not begin the attack in the lower cavern, but would be the first to reach the floor of that battlefield chamber in any significant numbers. Orethio Spikes led the second group, the largest and most prominent force, fronted by the wild dwarves of Citadel Adbar. They carried long lines of rope as they made for the main corridor and the landing, ready to rappel six at a time to the darkness below. 2,000 warriors and clerics formed this force, with more than 1,000 ready to hit the floor below and the rest supporting the battle from the landing and the corridors above. If the drow or their demonic allies found a way to get up behind the dwarves in the lower chamber, they'd find nearly 1,000 Adbarim and Mirabarim warriors ready to show them the error of their ways. King Emerus, Ragged Dane, and the third group held back. They would be the last to the fight, but perhaps the most important and the most daring.
"There are a lot of them,"
Kipper Harple remarked to Brunner and the others, looking at the mob of dwarves filling the side corridor and the antechambers that lined it.
"How many will get through before the exit is dispelled, I wonder? Is this plan not simply going to trap you in the cavern as just happened with poor King Conrad?"
"Only way down," Brunner replied. "Our enemies are below, and so we're going below.
We're counting on yourself and others to make sure it won't happen.
But once you are on the floor, Kipper started.
No running from this fight,
Brunner interrupted, and there was no debate to be found in his tone. Kipper, with a glance at a shrugging Penelope, conceded the point. Kipper Harple was the master of magical gates, dimensional doors, and the like, but Brunner had several hundred dwarves with him, all trying to negotiate quickly through the tight quarters of this side corridor. Perhaps they should have done this part of the attack from the throne room after all, as had been suggested. But no, despite his reservations and his very real fears that this fight would end up eerily similar to the one Keneally and Tuckernuck's magic had led, Kipper had to admit this tactic offered the best hope. He was close enough to the targeted area to use lesser spells to create his portal, and so he could quickly enact replacements if the initial one failed.
Once you're down there, I won't easily be able to get you out, he reminded Brunner.
Once I'm down there, only ones who'll be wanting me out are the damned drow,
Brunner replied without the slightest hesitation. Kipper took his place at the end of the side corridor and rubbed his hands together, awaiting the signal. Similarly, Catty Bree and Penelope, both readying the same dimensional gate spell as the old Harple, found appropriate locations nearby, where they could channel supporting lines of dwarves into the cavern. Tulliver Harple, meanwhile, cast his own spell, and a disembodied wizard eye floated back out of the corridor and into the main passageway, flitting past the lines of wild dwarves preparing their ropes and harnesses and out to the landing, where Arethio Spikes and his best fighters stood ready. The Ad-Barum warrior nodded and grinned at the approach of Tolliver's enchanted orb. That wizard eye served as the go signal.
For King Conorat, for Citadel Ad-Bar, for the Silver Marches, for Gontalgrim, for Delzoon,
Arethio Spikes whispered. And so it began, with Arethio and five others taking up their ropes and rolling off the landing, sliding down for the floor. And six more dwarves went right behind them. From the landing, the wizard eye went down alongside the dwarves, with Tolliver noting the landmarks and locations. Kipper launched into his casting. The first drow lightning bolt reached out to blast at the dwarves. The first demon howls echoed below as the lower level came awake to the threat. Arethio Spikes was the first dwarf to the floor, five others beside him, six more coming fast, and six more right behind them. But on came the goblin kin and the demon hordes, ready for the expected battle, and surely expecting to overwhelm this puny force in short order. Tolliver called out to the others.
No surprise! Our enemies were waiting for us!
Aye, and that's the way we knew it'd be, Brunner roared. Who's to stop a dwarf charge, I ask ye?
And the cheering erupted all along that side corridor, and dwarves began banging their weapons against their shields, and all crowded in on Kipper, who was in the thrall of spellcasting. Old Kipper prayed that he had the location correct, that Tolliver was relaying the information properly, as he at last completed his spell, connecting this corridor to the floor just to the right of Arethio Spikes.
Fools, Jaimus said, shaking his head in disbelief. We repelled them last time, and now they come down even more slowly and more vulnerably.
He looked to his cousin Phyllis, who was just completing his next lightning bolt. The spell shot off, and Phyllis nodded in satisfaction. The flash of his first bolt had shown him the target, and now this second streak of lightning had hit the mark, the magic slashing through one of the repelling ropes far up from the floor. The lowest dwarf on that rope was just jumping the last few feet to the ground. The next tumbled 15 feet or so, bounced and rolled back to his feet. The third on the rope fell from twice that height. He hit, buckled and groaned, grabbing at his legs. The fourth, the fifth, and the sixth crashed hard onto the floor. One of them was moaning, the other two lying silently and very still. Phyllis looked to Jaimus and shrugged, as much at a loss as to why the foolish dwarves would try something so obviously desperate as this after the first catastrophe, and indeed, among the piled remains of their dead kin. Drow would never be so stubborn or stupid as that, after all. But then the cousins heard a sudden onslaught of cheering, and the cavern brightened, a brightly glowing square of light just to the side of the main fighting.
"What is it?"
Phyllis asked.
"A gate!"
Jaimus yelled, and indeed it was. Through that portal came the battlehammers, led by Brunner himself, pouring out into the cavern just to the side of Arethio Spike's position.
Many of those dwarves came out bearing a small light stone, and they flung those illuminating orbs as prescribed, scattering them sequentially throughout the reaches of the huge cavern. The drow shied in pain and surprise. The cavern became as bright as daylight, brutal to underdark eyes. Demons and goblinkin hunched away and shielded their eyes, and the wall of battle hammers crashed into them like a stampede of crazed Rothay, stomping over them, smashing and slashing at them, burying them. Brunner ran right up the side of one Vrock, his axe whacking away with wild abandon, driving into the demon, pounding it down bit by bit. Standing atop the broken, destroyed thing, Brunner glanced back at Orethio's spikes, the two sharing a knowing nod.
"Vengeance," Brunner Battlehammer muttered quietly, but loud enough for Fury Fellhammer, Athrogate, and Ambergris to hear and echo the sentiment.
"Be quick," Kipper Harple implored the dwarves, still pouring through his portal, and to the other wizards who were only then enacting their spells. "They are trying to dispel the gate." Across the way, Catibri and Penelope focused on the sight through Kipper's gate, using that to aid in the placement of their own dimensional doorways. Neither was prolific enough with these types of spells to safely do as Kipper had done, locating and opening a gate merely on the words of Tolliver. But now with the target area clearly in their view, both had their spells successfully away. At that very moment, Kipper's gate went away, but it didn't matter. Two portals were in place now, and soon enough three, as the old mage opened yet another to replace the first. Several hundred battle hammers would be in that cavern before the drow or their demon allies could hope to close the gates. "Go, go," Catibri yelled to the other wizards, and all three rushed around the charging dwarves and back out into the main corridor, pausing to cast as they went. "You remember the ritual?" Penelope asked, and both Catibri and Kipper nodded. The Adbar dwarves, still rappelling along the ropes, five now but with a new sixth line soon to be in place, moved aside for the magic users and for the royal procession, King Emerus and Ragged Dane and a host of elite Felbaran warriors close behind them. As soon as they passed through the last door, Catibri and the three Harples flew away, Tolliver leading them down to the correct position near to the floor. Up on the landing, King Emerus, Ragged Dane, and the others chanted out a battle song, using the cadence to count as instructed. And when the second verse ended, fully confident in the wizards and their timing, the Felbarans leaped out into the open cavern, plummeting to within 10 feet of the floor before passing through the newly enacted Field of Feather Falling, then floating down to begin solidifying Orethio Spike's left flank. The shield walls were formed in the blink of a trained dwarf's eye, the dwarf ranks thickening precisely in the well-lit cavern. Drow darkness spells took some of that light away, but there weren't many Zorlarans in this cavern, and it was a feeble attempt indeed against the overwhelming number of lighted stones the dwarves had brought to bear. And now they were the tide, breaking waves made of rolling dwarves, following the leads of Brunner Battlehammer, Orethio Spikes, and Emerus Warcrown. Goblins, orcs, and demons died by the score, and the shield line would not be broken. Drow lightning and fire came at them, but so quick had the Felbaran assault filled the cavern that Catibri and the Harples too began to focus on more offensive spells. Thick ran the blood. Goblins and orcs piled deep in death, scores of manes lay smoking and melting on the floor, and many dwarves went to Moradin's Hall in those early moments of wild battle. But the line held, frustratingly so for those hungry demons who could not get to their bearded enemies, and so began attacking the other living creatures, the allied goblinkin, to satisfy their undeniable hunger. They were winning. Brunner understood that as again the dwarven line rolled forward and engulfed their enemies, curling up and down the length of the cavern like a breaking wave on a long beach, as inexorable and undeniable as the tide itself. They were winning, and it seemed to Brunner that the fight was quickly turning into a rout. Once they had this hold on the lower levels, with easy resupply from above, they could not be denied. The forge and the adjoining primordial chamber, the heart of Gontalgrim, would be theirs for the taking. Gontalgrim would be Delzoon once more, as Moradin had demanded. But something was off-kilter, Brunner felt, some emptiness within him that muted his joy at the moment of supreme victory.
Drizzt was not beside him now to share in his greatest triumph. For all their decades together, in this, the culmination of Brunner's achievements, Drizzt O'Erden was not there, and perhaps would never again be. His dearest friend, the greatest warrior he had ever known. He remembered his own dying words in his previous life, when he had looked into the eyes of his dear friend and whispered, "I found it, Elf." Aye, he had found Gontalgrim, the most ancient dwarven homeland, the greatest dwarven treasure of all, yet not because of dwarven help, but because a dark elf had stood beside his journey for decades, had suffered his wrong turns, had helped him through near disastrous battles, and in the end had led the way to put the primordial back in its captivity. Drizzt had done all of that for Brunner, for friendship, selflessly. Drizzt, who now had paid at long last for Brunner's dwarven needs. The red-bearded dwarf winced, feeling again as if this victory might prove hollow after all. In defiance, Brunner blew his cracked silver horn. Let the wild spirit of Thibeldorf Puent come forward, he decided, wanting to ultimately punish those who stood against him. Far from the roar of battle, the explosions of fire and lightning, the whipping ice storms of Penelope Harpel, and the latest shield rush led by Brunner Battlehammer, the Drow Ranger lay quietly in the darkness. His first sensations of semi-consciousness came from his fingers, playing over a familiar shape as they shifted across the onyx figurine of the panther. Somewhere distantly, Drizzt felt the warmth and heard the name of Guinevere echoing in his thoughts. Memories would not come back to him, nothing specific at least, just a feeling of companionship and joy. Images of his friends flashed in the recesses of his mind, of Catti Bree and Brunner mostly. And of Guinevere, the panther, the figurine that served as her beacon so tangible in Drizzt's weak hands. He could not hear the cries of dying dwarves, and could not know the battle raging far below, a battle then looking like victory to his friends. Somehow, though, Drizzt knew better. A pair of great demon leaders, Marilith and Nalfeshni, were waiting in the shadows and would soon come onto the battlefield and rally the demonic forces and the drow to turn back the tide of dwarves. Where the hopes and expectations of victory in his dearest friends would suddenly turn to dread. Another image flashed in his mind, but did not flutter aside. Instead, it held him and called to him. Demanded of Drizzt that he shake off the irresistible darkness, that he wake up. He saw Jarlaxle in his thoughts, and when he at last did open his weary eyes, Drizzt saw Jarlaxle once more, standing with Kimoriel beside his bed. "Welcome back,"